You're listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, a weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. Today, I'm talking to Antoine about what does it take to develop good patient-reported outcomes. It's a pretty cool episode, and so watch out for it. Patient-reported outcomes. The more you look into it, the more interesting it gets. There are so many different aspects on it, so many things that you don't learn about usually in university, or when you just do the kind of standard high-level clinical trial design stuff. There's a lot of really, really cool things in it, and lots of work for us statisticians. So stay tuned for this really good discussion with Antoine. Speaking about PROs, PRO is always also a topic for the PSI conference. There's always something about quality of life, there's always something about patient-reported outcomes, and there's so many new stuff happening in this field. So check out the PSI conference at psiweb.org and see you in June in Gothenburg, Sweden, at the conference. I'm really looking forward to meeting you face to face. Welcome to another episode of The Effective Statistician. And today I'm really happy to have Antoine here. How are you doing?
Fine, and you?
Very, very good. So today we are talking a little bit more about the patient side of things and what patients perceive to be, you know, the good or the bad side of treatments. And so patient-reported outcomes was always a real interesting topic for me. When I started in the industry, I was working a lot in the psychiatry area. And so, what the patients felt, thought, experience was always a very, very important point, because there's not so many kind of lab values or other things that you can actually look for other than on the safety side. So that was always a really, really interesting topic. So I'm really happy to have you here. To introduce you to the listener, maybe you can summarize a little bit how you arrived to where you are now.
Sure. So I was trained as a statistician. And in fact, from the very beginning, I would say I focused on patient-centered outcome, patient-reported outcomes. I did the PhD where the topic was about patient-reported outcomes and the cross-cultural validation of PRO measures. And this was 20 years ago. And we from there, I always worked in this field doing statistics and psychometrics on patient-reported outcome data, clinician-reported outcome data, anything that comes to scale. Mm-hmm. And I've been a consultant for industry virtually all this time, helping companies dealing with their PRO data.
Yeah.
And
The psychometrics is actually a really interesting part. I only learned about this after university. Lots of the different things I really didn't know about. Well, I knew about a couple of these things, but these were actually more from linear algebra than from statistics. That's a really interesting field. But let's start a little bit back. Why actually, you know, do companies develop new patient-reported outcomes all the time? Why is that so much a, you know, why don't we have just kind of, okay, indication X, then you take these patient-reported outcomes, and there's a lot of kind of generic ones that you can use all the time. Why do we need to develop all the time new ones?
Yes, it's a good question. So why the question is, aren't we reinventing the wheel, I guess? Well, in fact, I think if you comet in a broader sense, it's about innovation. I mean, for imaging also, we are always improving imaging, MRIs, etc. And for in fact, for PROs, it's the same. These are measurement instruments. We can always improve them. And in fact, it's a very, as you said, in psychiatry, I think we can realize that how complex it is to measure patient experience.
Yeah.
It's not an easy thing. And of course, we need to put a lot of effort. So we have been developing instruments for more than 30 years, probably, but there are still more to do. And in fact, if you think about it, this complexity is because there are two key concepts in our field, which are concept of interest and context of use. So basically, what you want to measure in what context. And the combination of these two elements are very makes a lot of different situations that requires always more precise or more better understanding. So for instance, the concept of interest. So you need to define as precisely as possible the concept you want to measure. And of course, some concepts are very widely measured in different areas, but still they may not be exactly means the exact same thing in different areas. Physical functioning is measured virtually in every condition, but maybe physical functioning in one area is not exactly the same as in another. And then you have also more complex concepts like fatigue. Fatigue is a very important concept in many. We say more and more we see how important the concept is, but how do you define fatigue? What is it? And for instance, we worked on this and we published a paper last year about the conceptualization of fatigue. And you realize it's much more complex than, well, it's a very complex thing, but there are different forms of fatigue, physical fatigue, cognitive fatigue, elements like susceptibility of fatigue, how quickly you become fatigued, like, you know, a battery of a telephone. And so all this needs to be very carefully thought of. And the more we learn, the better we can measure, and then we can develop new measures. And the same for the context of use, because you won't use this necessarily the same instrument in different diseases, even if it's the same concept, in different populations, depending on severity of the disease. Like in early Parkinson's, you would not necessarily need to apply the same instrument than in late Parkinson's, because what's really important to patients at different stages of the disease is not the same. And you may not also apply the same instrument in the context of a clinical trial and in clinical practice, or also depending on what the standard of care is, because if you want to compare to another to certain other treatments, maybe the concept that you will want to differentiate with will not be the same. Or so all this together needs, we want to demonstrate our treatment effects. The first thing is to define what is the concept you want to assess and what context. And with all this together, you can search whether there is an existing instrument. But in fact, there is often not a good instrument for this specific context of use and concept of interest. So that's why then you say, okay, we'll need to develop a new one.
Okay. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. If I'm going into, don't know, if I use something that was originally developed for, let's say, oncology, and now I'm going into an area where maybe, you know, the average person is 18 years old or something like this, that's likely a completely different topic in terms of, is the life of an 18 years old is probably very different than, you know, most of the oncology populations.
Yeah. And in fact, what we see more and more is new ways of approaching this question, because, I mean, I would say 10 years ago, we would not capitalize on the existing instruments. And now more and more we capitalize on existing instruments, meaning that we looked at the existing instrument maybe in other fields or in the same area, but maybe for slightly different population, and we would try to start from there and maybe enhancing the instrument by adding new items. So that's the kind of thing we do more and more. We have a few examples like this where, for instance, in the multiple sclerosis, we looked at instruments that were used, in fact, in stroke first, and then it was moved to multiple sclerosis, and it was about manual ability. And we realized that we were lacking items to capture the very early signs, and then you could go to add items to make the instruments better. So you see, starting from what exists and improving it. And it's also the idea of all the item banks that exist. So basically, the big item banks, in particular in oncology, but I mean also in other fields, where you have existing items and you can fine tune your instruments to make sure that you're measuring exactly what you need for your specific context of use.
What actually is an item bank?
So an item bank is, in fact, it's the repository of items that have been developed in the field and that been calibrated so that you can create instruments that are that can be used picking items from that exist already and that have been put on a continuum. And in fact, it's also the basis for computer adaptive testing. So basically, this is a more technological advanced approach to measurement in which you would the patient would not complete the full questionnaire or a fixed form. So basically, always all patients would complete the exact same items. They would complete items depending on their on the response they gave to the previous one. So that it kind of reduces the burden to patient because they just complete items that are fit for them. And in fact, there is an algorithm behind it so that it gives exactly what are the best question depending on their previous responses.
Yeah, so that is something that I actually haven't heard about before because I'm still used to kind of see the paper forms where, and it's the same for every patient and you have these 10 or 20 items that you go through. By the way, for the listener, an item is a question, usually yes, together question, yeah. With an answer that can be kind of, you know, something like a Likert scale from
yeah,
one
scale.
To five or visual analog scale or whatever, something like this.
No. Yeah. No, a lot, et cetera. So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that's cool. So, and when I want to develop a new questionnaire, so because my drug has this specific advantage in, you know, this new concept, and that is not well captured on, at least not well captured in the specific context. How do I actually start with developing such a new questionnaire?
Talking to patients. First thing you need to do is talk to patients. I mean, it's kind of the bottom line of many cases, but here it's really very important because what you want to measure is exact capturing the very experience of patients. So that's the main aspect when you develop an instrument, it's talking to patients. So in fact, what we really start doing and what's really is doing as done is to review the literature. So make sure that nothing exists, but also review the literature, what we call the qualitative research literature. So really all the reports on studies that have, in which patients have given their, or reported on their experience. So, you know, patient interviews, patient focus groups, anything that has been already published in this very area. Typically, it wouldn't be enough. You would have to set up specific qualitative research study where you would speak to patients to understand what is the experience, what is exactly that the perceived for this specific concept. So you would speak to anywhere between 20, well, probably, yeah, depending if it's a very rare disease, you can go as low as 15 probably, but the more patient you have, more patient feedback you have, and you want to also have feedback from patient with different perspectives, so also different from severity, different subgroups often, maybe also gender, age, the group depending on the context of your disease, and you get the most precise understanding of what is it that the patient have to go through and how you want to do this. So then once you have all this, you create what we call a conceptual model. So basically we put the different types of or part of the experience of patients into buckets, saying, well, this is symptoms. So what kind of symptoms do they have? Gastrointestinal, neurological, et cetera. Impacts, what kind of impact all these symptoms have on their life, physical function impact, daily activities impact, social activities, et cetera. So you can get a full picture. And then based on this, you can really focus the development of the instruments to develop items, questions, response scale that are good for this population. So that's really what you would start with. And once so we
these,
see
these focus groups, there's it's really kind of you have a discussion, a longer discussion with the patients to learn about how they call these different things, what are these specific areas. And to see how is also changes across the population of patients. Okay. Yeah.
So in fact, we for our development on of an instrument, we tend to prefer one-to-one interviews, but it mm-hmm. could be like interviews for 1 hour with patients to really get a sense of what they go through. And as you said, we also understand how they talk about it, because then you can reuse the words they use to make sure that when you write an item, because then you have to write this item, you have to write this question, you have to make sure that it is simple, understood by patients.
Yeah.
So you reusing the words that you have heard during the interviews is really, really important.
Yeah. And, so and I wanted... if the patient says, these, you know, pain is stitchy or something like this, then you include these kind of adjectives.
Exactly. Yeah. And in fact, what we do more and more now is to also start collect quantitative data at this stage, very early on. So with small samples that are interviews to get a first sense of how well these items would work. So we can get a first sense of this. So that's what we call mixed methods research, really combining the data from the qualitative research and data from early, data from the qualitative research and data from the early quantitative research we can get. So that's where we start.
Cool. So basically, as a statistician, you're involved directly from the start?
Yes. Well, now we would be very much involved from the start. I would say that, again, a few years back, it was really sequential. So the qualitative research importance really started probably already before, but in the early 2000s, there were a lot of push for more qualitative research. But what would happen is that qualitative researcher would do the research, talk to patients, create the items, and then you would develop a big validation study in which the questionnaire would have been given to, a few hundreds of patients. And then the psychometricians would receive this. And then off you go and start trying to understand how you would score the instruments. So basically the score is how you aggregate responses to different item sets. To create the measure, so the score. So it could be anywhere from a simple sum to a transform sum or even more sophisticated scoring. But so it would be the psychometrician who would do this. So and then to reduce the number of items, etc., and create the score and develop the and evaluate the measurement properties of the instruments. So that would have been really sequential. Then slowly, the statistician or the psychometrician was involved more and more earlier and earlier. So, in the beginning, it was just I was involved, for instance, in the item generation process to give my opinion on okay, you should avoid doing this kind of question because when I will score it, it will create issues. So that was involved more and more. And
what
then,
kind of issues? What like, you were thinking about, yeah.
Like, if you have this kind of question, one of the important question was, do we want to add or not non-applicable response options? Because it could create issues depending on the scoring you want to do at the end. So this kind of design, item design question also, you don't want to have items going to in one direction in positive and or negative, because then maybe you can have a method effect. You know, this kind of things that, you know, as a psychometrician with some experience that will come up when you create your score, you can tell from the beginning, okay, this kind of item will not make it.
So
we started like this, and now we that mixed method research, as I said, is more and more used, and we have created some mixed methods. It's really one of area that I really was really involved in mixed methods, and now we really push to have this from the very beginning to get some data early on, and so that we can give also our insights. And for instance, you can tell this item is endorsed, in fact, by very few patients. It will not make it. Or here you have an issue with your response scale. We don't want to have four or five response categories. Maybe four will be really enough because patients don't really use all of them. So all these kind of things you can tell from the beginning, which kind of speed up the process because you have data very early on. So it's not just qualitative. It's also a first sense of how well it will work when you create your score and then measure your concept. So a lot of things.
How do you decide on the number? So I think I know two kind of typical things. One is this kind of ordered categorical thing. Yeah, like mild, moderate, severe, very severe, or things like that.
Yes.
And the other thing is this visual analog scale. Like you have kind of 10 centimeters and then from no pain at all to the worst pain you can imagine, and then mark where you think your pain is. How do you decide actually at the beginning whether you use this visual analog scale or something like this ordered categorical scales?
So I would say that we tend to see fewer and fewer visual analog scales.
Okay.
We see numerical rating scales, which are in fact probably a little more easier for the scoring algorithm in particular, because it's like the pain numerical rating scale NRS, where you say between 0 and 10, and in fact you have 10, you have 11 response categories, which is much more than a typical Likert scale. So I think the choice between this is mostly related to the concept that you want to measure. For instance, the 11 point NRS for pain is a classic, and I think it works pretty well. And I was always impressed by how well it worked, because you can tell how can really a patient distinguish between 11 level of pain, and I can tell you they can. I can tell you that it's possible. But when we try to apply this kind of response scale to other concepts, didn't work necessarily so well. So it's really a question of the concept, and again testing the question and seeing whether patient can discriminate between different levels. And the methods that are more and more used now, which are what we call modern psychometrics, even though they are 15 years old now, like item response theory or rash measurement theory, really provide tools to understand the response scales and really understand how the patients can respond to different level of categories. So it can really give you a very good insight. And regarding the number of categories, there is kind of a belief that the more item categories, the more responsive your scale is. And in fact, it's not always the case, because sometimes if the patient can't really distinguish between the two adjacent response categories, in fact, it gives you more noise than anything. So it's not necessarily a good idea. So we tend now to say, well, maybe having fewer response categories, but maybe having items that captures maybe more subtle differences. So it's not in the response category, but in the question itself that you have the gradient of severity. It could lead to better tools, and in fact also easier for patients, because they don't have to think about I am a mild or I'm a moderate. Well, in fact, maybe it's the same. Or I mean, it's a response question like a little and quite a bit, for instance. Okay, what is the difference between a little and quite a bit? Well, that's not necessarily easy.
Yeah, but if you're more specific in terms of the item, is it don't know, burning pain, or is it a different type of pain?
Exactly.
Then it's much more easier to say, okay, this is moderate or this is severe. Yeah, and I don't have burning pain. Or
another
like
way
that.
Is to add a qualifier. So basically, an example: shortness of breath. You can have shortness of breath at rest. Can have shortness of breath with mild exertion, so like the walking, or shortness of breath when climbing stairs. And then the question itself gives you an idea of the severity much more than the response, which would be, okay, do you experience shortness of breath? Well, it depends on the situation. And if you put the different situation, then you can have a more breadth of coverage of the concept, which could be very, and it is also very good, because it's easier for the patient, and it's also easier for interpretation, because then you can tell, okay, in this situation there is a problem, but not in this population. For instance, COPD, okay, patients can work, but they can't, or this is very severe because they can't even work. They walk, they have to stay home, and even worse, there is shortness of breath even when they rest. And this is a very severe case.
Yeah. I think that's actually a very interesting point. I've seen that in, for example, in Alzheimer. Yeah, if you look into some of these Alzheimer scales, you see that certain items only actually make sense in certain severities of the population. Yeah, so I did some kind of research on it, kind of how much do kind of items differentiate based on the total score? Yeah. And you can really see kind of if you go through with a total score from no symptoms to little symptoms, yeah, certain items actually, you know, really change, where certain other items, they just are still at zero. Yeah, zero, kind of, there's still no change in speech or something like this. Whereas if you go to the more severe ones, yeah, all the earlier ones have already kind of went to the most severe category, yeah, and now the other items start to change.
Exactly. Yeah?
And so I think that's a really interesting concept that, you know, different items are applicable to different severities of the disease.
Yeah, and it's actually a very topical question and a very important thing, because the more we advance, the more innovation there is in the drug development, the more the earlier we treat patients, in fact, in particular in neurodegenerative, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. And the question is, can we use the instruments that were developed originally for more severe patients to capture change or early progression in the disease in less severe? And there you can see that the standard measure may lack sensitivity at least for these very patients. There was quite a lot of work on Alzheimer's for existing instruments. We are actually part of the consortium where we're working with metrology institutes. So metrology is the science of measurement. So we try, it's another innovation. We try to bring in the field to work with people who are working with measurements. So basically, people would define what a kilogram is, etc., and to see how they do this and whether we can do it also for our kind of measurements. And so we have this European initiative which is called Neuromet, and where we look at the measurement of memory for Alzheimer's and trying to develop tools that would fit this kind of quality assurance that you can have from metrology. And one of the key questions is, okay, can we separate between normal mild cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's and have the right tools to do this? So that's exactly what you said. We're saying in Alzheimer's.
Yeah. So being able to separate between different groups of patients is one thing. I think the other thing that is directly comes to mind is that you can easily also detect changes over time within a patient.
Yes.
What other quality aspects would you look into when you have a new PRO to show that it's a good measurement?
Well, it's an art. it takes a lot of experience. Well, I think, in fact, it's not exactly true. I think the first thing I always recommend is read the questions. If it's a patient-reported outcomes, read the question. You can't imagine the number of people who are using instruments who haven't read the actual questionnaire. And even for a statistician analyzing data from a clinical trial, I would always recommend, before you do anything, read the questionnaire, because if you read the questionnaire, you understand what it is about and you understand how you can use it and how you can analyze it. So I think it's very important for us, but also in general, because it can gives you an idea of, if you can't make sense of the question, you're sure the patient won't be able to make sense out of it. So I think that the first thing is try to put yourself in the patient's shoe and read it and see whether you would be able to respond to this question. And sometimes, and even for questions that are very widely used, I can tell you they are not so good, because when you read them, they don't make sense. So that's the first rule. Then what I like to do is to try to to talk with clinicians to get a sense of what are the clinical aspects and see whether they are reflected also from the patient perspective in the questionnaire. I think it's very important to have both aspects. So the question needs to be important to patients. So that's important that the questionnaire has been developed involving patients. So the question, when you read the paper, you need to make sure that patients have been interviewed, they have been really involved, so that the questionnaire reflects patient experience, but also it's important that it's also in line with some clinical hypotheses, and that's very important. So that would be it. And then looking at the development of the validation papers, so the psychometric papers, and validity, reliability have been analyzed for years. It's very important, but I think that one of the key elements is the targeting. So that's what we have been talking all along. So how well this set of items fit the population in the sample that I want to measure. So, and that again, where modern psychometrics, rush measurement theory, when you can compare where the items sits on a continuum compared to the sample, mm-hmm. because it's a model that puts the patients, well, the responders and the items on the same metric. So you can actually see, okay, these items match my population or not. And that's, in fact, this property drives a lot of things, because if they don't match, you will have floor effect, so you won't be able to detect change. Mm-hmm. You will not be able to discriminate your sample, so a question in terms of reliability. So really, this question of how well the items match the sample is a critical aspect, because it's, in a clinical trial in particular, if you don't have this, you won't be able to detect the treatment effect. Yeah. And there are a lot of cases where it's okay, where it happens.
Yeah, so floor and ceiling effects is basically when, you know, nearly all your patients scores the lowest or the highest, yeah? And then, well, if there's no variability, then, well, you can't see anything.
And if your patients are at the maximum already, you won't be able to improve them. So you need to have more items that kind of extend the ruler. You have to go further.
Yeah. Or if all are on the lowest, then you need to look, you know, more closer and see, or does that item actually make sense anyway? So like in the Alzheimer area, if you look into mild patients, certain symptoms in Alzheimer just don't occur in these patient population. So adding these is just adding, noise and doesn't help you. And burden to the patient, by the way.
It's another big question. In fact, we already have this question. How many questions? We don't want to overburden the patients, which is true. We don't want to have patients completing a lot of questions. But I would say, if the questions are not useful, because if the question, and I think that's one of the big issues in clinical trials, is that we ask the patient a lot of questions, but maybe we don't use all of them. Because we use, for instance, the full questionnaire, that had been developed 30 years ago and has a lot of questions, but in fact, half of them are completely irrelevant to this patient population. Yeah. So maybe instead of asking these 15 questions, let's ask another 15, but that are really relevant. And then this, for me, this is really patient burden.
I've seen protocols where, it took the patient maybe half an hour to fill in all the questionnaires. Yeah. And some of these are even kind of overlapping. And you kind of go through and think like, didn't I answer that question already? Or a similar question on another earlier questionnaire? So these can be quite burdensome. But you mentioned that there's new development to have more kind of targeted questionnaires by having kind of questionnaires that change depending on how you respond to it. Like, do you have the symptom? And then, more questions about the symptom will come up, things like that, I guess. So how do you actually develop that? That sounds really sophisticated.
Well, yeah. So this is inspired by other fields, because in other fields you have this kind of systems where you don't ask to all the questions you can imagine to a patient. Yeah. You have to select. In health, it's more, well, it's starting to be more and more used. To be honest, there are still some regulatory questions about it, because if you don't ask the same question to a patient, how can you make sure? I mean, the question is, how can you make sure that you can pool and compare? So that's obviously an important question. But in terms of technique, it's really based on this notion of modern psychometrics, and again, the rush measurement theory is really important here, because you would have a continuum and all your items are calibrated. And that's the key word. They have to be calibrated.
What does that mean, calibrated?
It's exactly the same as any measurement instrument that you have. When you have a scale in your home, it is calibrated, so that if you use this scale, you have 1 kilogram on this scale, it will be the same mass as on another scale. So you have to have this this process that makes sure that you, what when you are using a measurement instrument, you can trust the result and you can compare afterwards. Yeah. And if you, and it's also if you, you weight two different objects, you can still compare the weight, the mass, in fact. And that's very, it's very, very important for any measurement instrument. And for PROs, we realize that it's very important too. And this calibration means that the items needs to, well, you need to understand what level of the concept is measured by each item very precisely. Mm-hmm. So that depending on the response of the patient to this item, it gives you an idea, a precise idea of where they, where they sit on this continuum, on this metric. So that's where you have to run analysis up front to estimate the parameters for the items on a sample large enough to have reliable estimates and with as little uncertainty as possible. And then you get this calibration. And then once you have this, you can, as I said, you can have algorithm that that can be applied depending on the response of one item. So basically, if they say they are above a certain threshold, you will ask this question, and if they are below, you will ask the other one, etc. And so the more you go, the more precise your estimation of the person parameters. So basically, where they sit on the parameters that says where they sit on the continuum, where it is. So basically, the score, if you want to see, it kind of makes the score more and more precise. And then at some point you say, okay, it's precise enough, I can stop, and I don't need to ask more questions.
So it's basically like, okay, if I start with a very kind of wide question, that helps me to understand where on the continuum the patient is.
Yes.
And then I see, okay, if he's on the more mild area, then I look into items that are more relevant there. And more and more into these different things. Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yes, it's cool. Again, I can't wait the time when we will be able to implement this in clinical trials, because it will change things dramatically.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. Yeah, and also makes it much more kind of applicable to the patients. Because I think, you know, answering lots of questions like not applicable, no, is kind of a little bit, pointless.
Yeah.
Cool. So when we want to develop new guidelines and want to use them with the FDA or the EMA, not new guidelines, we want to develop new PROs, what kind of guidelines are out there?
So, the standard one is the FDA one, which was published in 2009, the patient-reported outcome guidance. But more recently, the FDA started, still a few years now, they have the patient-focused drug development program. So they have put together a lot of effort to update this guidance. So now there are four work stream or four aspects. One guidance is final, and there are three others that are ongoing, which will bring more information. For instance, they introduce the notion of mixed methods. There is a lot of discussion about meaningfulness of the how you interpret the scores. That's a key aspect for PROs, because there is no metric. So how can you tell that this change is meaningful or this is meaningful? There's a lot of work around this, and there is a large part of one guidance, which is about this. It's about data collection. It's about developing instrument. It's about interpreting instrument or implementing instrument in clinical trials. And this is all in ongoing in the PFDD, so Patient Focused Drug Development Program of FDA. So it can be found on the FDA website. So that's the most comprehensive guidance. At EMA, there are a few aspects, but much less for development than using clinical trials. For instance, in the oncology, there is an appendix to the oncology guidance, which is about quality of life and PROs that you can use in this specific field. So ICH also had some development about PROs or patient-centered outcome research. So there are a few, and it's always evolving. And what we have now is documents, for instance, for protocols. So there is a Spirit Pro, So basically, when you have a PRO endpoint in your clinical trial protocol, what do you need to look at? So it's peer-pro papers. There's a consult pro for reporting. And there is currently an initiative which is called CISAQOL, which is the an international initiative that is looking at the standardizing the way PRO endpoints are analyzed in cancer trials in oncology. So you see a lot of going
lots
of
lots of lots of things
for standardization. Yeah.
That is brilliant. So thanks so much for this really, really great discussion. We started with kind of where and why we actually need patient-reported outcomes and why this will never stop potentially. And, you know, what is context and what are concepts and what statisticians and psychometricians can bring to the table to ensure we have high quality patient reported outcomes and what is quantitative and qualitative research in this area. And finally, kind of what are key areas you need to look into to make sure that you have actually a high quality PROs. And also, what are the regulatory aspects of that? So it's just kind of thinking about all the different things we talked about. We probably can have a couple of further episodes about this topic.
Yeah, we can have a series. But I think for me, the last point I want to make, which is very much in line with what you're always saying, this is key because this is how to bring the patient's voice into clinical development. I think that's what we try to do, and that we want to make sure that the patient, we are faithful to the patient's voice, and we can really make clinical development for patients, and that at the end, the life is improved, and we can demonstrate that the treatment improves lives of patients. And that's why I'm so passionate about it, because I think it's really making a difference.
I completely agree. It's kind of, I was just yesterday at a physician, and he asked me, what kind of doctor are you? And I said, well, I'm a statistician and I work in this field. And we talked about kind of how data is conveyed to physicians and to patients. And he said, it's so difficult to understand what actually all these different things mean. Yeah. And if we can't explain to a physician or a patient how they will benefit, what they will expect from the treatment, that's really bad, because then, you know, they can't make trade-off decisions. Yeah, they can't say, will I accept these kind of side effects? Yeah, or things like that, because they can't, you know, understand what would be the benefits. And so I think this is a really, really important area of research. And there's also patients are more and more taking actions, are much more kind of knowledgeable about that disease. And I think the time where you just go to your physician, the physician decides, and you kind of adhere to it, are largely gone, I think.
It is, yes, it's time are gone, yeah. But it's good, in fact, it's very good. It's good that the patients are on board.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Awesome discussion, and all the best with your further career in that area, and keep on pushing these things forward, because it's really, really important.
Thank you, Alexander.
This show was created in association with PSI, and the PSI conference happens in June. Don't forget to register. Thanks to Rain, who helps with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.